We are Radio Catskill.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, local residents oppose a plan to close Route 17's exit 114 leading into the village of Wurtsboro. It's part of the New York Department of Transportation's plan to upgrade Route 17 to interstate standards. We'll hear from State Senator Peter Oberrocker, local officials and community members who were at a rally yesterday to address the potential economic and safety impacts of the closure. Another election day is coming up. New York voters head to the polls June 25th to make their choices for the June primary. In Sullivan and Orange counties, Republicans are choosing their candidate for the 100th Assembly District. This morning, we'll bring you the first of two interviews with those candidates. We'll hear from Camille O'Brien. Plus, how to be a better beekeeper and the Roots and Rhythm Festival in Honesdale. But first, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Former President Donald Trump is visiting with congressional Republicans today in a series of meetings near Capitol Hill. It's his first official visit there since he left office. NPR's Barbara Sprunt says the Republicans are expected to talk with Trump about how to unify as a party ahead of the fall elections.
Lawmakers say they want to have the chance to ask Trump how they can be helpful to him these last months of the campaign. And something to watch for is whether they get into areas where there's some disagreement. Trump talks a lot about the last election being rigged. It's something some congressional Republicans would like to move away from. And there's issues like Ukraine. Trump is opposed, but there remains blocks of lawmakers who do want to support Ukraine.
NPR's Barbara Sprunt reporting. President Biden is attending the G7 summit in Italy. The leaders there have now reached an agreement to provide a massive loan to Ukraine. It's worth about $50 billion. The loan would be financed through the interest that comes from the value of frozen Russian assets. The interest is piling up at the rate of about $3 billion a year. Forecasters say it's going to keep pouring rain in southern Florida today. Heavy rain has been pounding the region since Tuesday, triggering flash flooding. The National Weather Service says some parts of the state have gotten as much as 18 inches of rain this week. As NPR's Greg Allen reports, the governor has declared a state of emergency in five counties.
An area of low pressure has dropped heavy rain over the southern half of the Florida Peninsula for days. The area around Fort Lauderdale has seen extensive flash flooding. High waters delayed operations at the airport there and in Miami. Interstate 95 was shut down near Fort Lauderdale, leading to a massive backup of stranded motorists. The heavy rains are expected to continue in Florida through Friday, producing 3 to 5 inches per hour in some areas. After the system passes through the state into the Atlantic, all eyes will be on another low-pressure system now developing in the Gulf of Mexico. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Stocks opened mixed this morning as the Labor Department reported a drop in wholesale prices last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped more than 200 points in early trading.
Wholesale prices fell last month and are up just 2.2% over the last 12 months. The news that wholesale inflation is cooling comes a day after the Labor Department reported lower than expected inflation at the retail level. Nevertheless, the Federal Reserve is holding interest rates steady for now. Fed policymakers say they'll be cautious about cutting rates in the future. New claims for unemployment benefits rose last week. 242,000 people applied for jobless aid, 13,000 more than the week before. Tesla CEO Elon Musk says preliminary results of a non-binding vote show shareholders want to restore his pay package, worth up to $56 billion. A Delaware judge threw out that package earlier this year. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow's down about 215 points. The Nasdaq is up 400 points. This is NPR. The Southern Baptist Convention has ended its annual meeting held this year in Indiana. Delegates voted to oppose the use of in vitro fertilization. Delegates also voted to narrowly reject an official ban on women serving as pastors. The United Nations Refugee Agency says a historic number of people worldwide were forced from their homes last year. The agency blames conflict, persecution, human rights violations, and the climate crisis. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The report finds the number of forcibly displaced has continued to rise and now stands at more than 120 million. High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi says this is the 12th consecutive year in which this figure has gone up.
Conflict remains a very, very big driver
of displacement. Last year, UNHCR declared 43 emergencies in 29 countries.
The report says key factors driving these surging displacement numbers are the devastating conflicts in Sudan, Gaza, and Myanmar. The UNHCR says most refugees are hosted by developing countries, not by rich countries. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
Netflix says it'll show a hot dog eating competition in September between hot dog eating champ Joey Chestnut and rival Takeru Kobayashi. The event's called Unfinished Beef. This week, Chestnut was barred from the annual Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest because he signed a deal with the maker of plant-based hot dogs. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Nature Conservancy, working across oceans and isles to cut carbon emissions, protect lands and waters, and support local communities for a future where people and nature thrive. Nature.org/solutions.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. State Senator Peter Oberrocker of New York's 51st District in our listening area held a news conference at Veterans Memorial Park in Wurtsboro yesterday morning to try to convince the New York State Department of Transportation that closing exit 114 on Route 17 westbound would be detrimental to the village of Wurtsboro. The proposed closure is part of a New York DOT plan to upgrade Route 17 to interstate standards. About 50 people came to listen to the senator, local officials, and community members talk about how the closure might impact local businesses. Radio Catskill's Patricio Rubio was there and has more.
Residents and business owners are concerned about the potential closure of exit 114 on New York State Route 17 West. This closure is proposed as part of the Route 17 expansion project, which aims to improve a 30-mile section of New York State Route 17 from exit 113 in Wurtsboro to Interstate 87 in Woodbury, Orange County. The project intends to address operational and safety issues, reduce congestion, and ensure the corridor meets interstate standards. State Senator for the 51st District, Peter Oberrocker, was joined with local officials, business owners, and residents at a rally in the village of Wurtsboro over the closure of Exit 114 on Wednesday, June 12th at Veterans Park.
I know exactly, believe me, I know personally what doing what they're proposing would do to the traffic, for the economics that it would be impacted here, okay? For the quality of life that Wurtsboro brings. And there's also another portion of that. You know, I'm a volunteer firefighter, been a volunteer firefighter since 1996, a member of my emergency squad as well. There's a public safety aspect of what we're talking about that I don't think quite Region 9 fully either understands. So I plan on bringing that back in very strong terms and to let them know that this is all of those things, but more importantly, it is a public safety issue as well. It's a plan that's ill-conceived, there's no doubt, and it's a plan that I plan on bringing back when I sit down and to say, I think we can improve upon this. I know we can improve upon this. And in the interim, what is this going to do is it's going to keep this vital community alive. We're going to protect the constituents that are in my district and the folks of New York.
Residents in the village of Wurtsboro are concerned about the planned closure of the main exit into the village, which could put the village in jeopardy. Some say the small village won't survive if they close the exit. Here's Kelly DeGuzman, vice president of the Wurtsboro Board of Trade.
First would be about the businesses located along Sullivan Street. Cutting off traffic flow coming from 114, from exit 114 on Route 17 would mean that we just get bypassed. And we're afraid that small business owners would be hurt by that. Yeah, it would be very detrimental. The second point would just be the emergency services and the safety concerns with closing 114. If an accident were to happen, which does very frequently between 114 and 113, diverting flow off of Route 17 through the village is a major safety or detour that is utilized often. In addition to increased response times for emergency vehicles, ambulances and fire trucks, on top of the business owners that may be impacted and residents, the safety concerns are also there. And I think Senator Oberrocker understands both of those.
Nick Solomon, Sullivan County Legislature for District 4, said if the plans go forward, the village of Wardsboro can become a ghost town.
Many people won't come to the village. They'll be getting off 113, taking 209. Traffic will be backed up. And then what'll happen is half the people are not going to make a right to go down Sullivan Street. They won't even know there's a Sullivan Street. They'll keep going toward Ellenville, and it'll hurt our business. Will be another park fill. That's why it's important to keep the 114 open.
Frank Sisco, mayor for the village of Wardsboro, stated that the closing of the exit would spell the end for the historic village.
Our businesses are located along Sullivan Street, which 114 directly feeds. You get off 114, you come directly in through Sullivan Street. So, yeah, it'd be a huge issue. The traffic, the DOT estimates 3,000 cars a day come through the village on Sullivan Street. We'd lose that. We'd cut that by 60 to 75%. Our village would crumble. The businesses wouldn't survive. You know, the people that are coming through here are just stopping to go to the businesses. They all say, yeah, use 113, but 113 bypasses our main street and all the village businesses are. And that's an issue. It's an issue.
All right, man.
So it would hurt us. I think over time, it would take a couple of years, but I think you'd see the village just crumble.
Because no one's going down Sullivan Street.
No one's coming down Sullivan Street. If they get off 113, they're going to Ellenville. They're going to Kingston. They're not stopping here. They're going to drive right by. All our businesses are here.
And I was talking to someone else about the potential traffic that could cause in the main intersection there.
Yeah. And even in the summertime, you see the influx of traffic for the summer people come up. 209 is going to be hugely busy. They estimate 10 to 12,000 cars a day now without the summer traffic. I can only imagine what it would do if you took all this traffic off this road and put it on 209.
Right.
It's pretty bad.
So as a mayor, what are your next steps right now?
Right now, you know, all we can do is we have a petition out there that people have signed that we've turned into DOT. We've talked to our legislators and the county, starting from the county all the way up through the state. We've had federal legislators, assembly people. All we can do is keep the pressure on and hopefully the DOT listens to us. And historically, that exit up there was created in the 1950s when they built 17, because Sullivan Street used to be the main highway. When they bypassed the village with the highway that's out there now, the village elders back in the 50s fought for that exit. That's how that exit was created. So this is just, it's full circle. It's just starting all over again.
You know? And you look at historically what happened to, like, in Parksville.
Correct.
Because the Quickway was through Parksville when they built 17.
When they bypassed Parksville, it was bad enough when they built 17 and bypassed Parksville. It started crumbling Parksville, but then when they redid that area and put the road up on the mountain and moved it even further away, Parksville turned into a ghost town. The hotels closed, businesses closed, everything closed.
Right.
Even though there was an exit for it, people didn't use it. They didn't get off from Parksville. There was nothing there.
Right.
Over time, there was nothing left. And that's what we're afraid is going to happen here. Those of us who live here care for this village. It's a very historical village. There's a lot of history here going back into the 1700s. It's going to go away. If they bypass this, it's going to go away.
Right.
Maybe 10 years, 20 years, but it's going to go away. And that's what we're fighting for, to keep it.
The State Department of Transportation will be holding public hearings in the near future and will be providing an environmental impact statement to the Federal Highway Administration, which will help decide the fate of Sullivan County's Exit 114. In Liberty, I'm Patricio Robayo for Radio Catskill.
Thank you to Patricio for that report. We'll take a break, and when we come back, our local election coverage continues with interviews concerning the June 25th GOP primary candidates. We'll hear from one of them next. This is Radio Chatsco.
It's summertime.
On the next Folk Plus, here comes summer. Songs about ice cream trucks, Ferris wheels, carnivals, beaches, lifeguards. It's summertime on the next Folk Plus, Sunday at 4.
People talk about polarization, but did you know most of us are in the hopeful majority, tired of political divisions and looking for a way out? That's why Radio Catskill and StoryCorps invite you to have a conversation with someone different and not so different than you. It's one small step where strangers get to know each other as people. Help bridge the divide, one conversation at a time. Sign up at wjffradio.org.
StoryCorps is one small step, and the radio station helps are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. New York voters will head to the polls June 25th to make their choices for this year's June primary. In Sullivan and parts of Orange County, Republicans will be choosing their candidate for the 100th Assembly District. Early voting starts this Saturday. Two candidates are vying for the GOP nomination, Camille O'Brien and Lou Ingracia. As part of our local election 2024 coverage, we'll be bringing you interviews with both candidates. First, Jason Dole spoke to O'Brien, currently Director of Community Outreach for State Senator Peter Oberacker.
Camille O'Brien is Director of Community Outreach for Senator Peter Oberacker's office in New York's 51st Senate District. She's one of the Drug Task Force coordinators for Sullivan County, and Camille O'Brien is running in the Republican primary election for the seat of the 100th Assembly District in New York, and that's why she's here with me today. Camille, welcome back to Radio Catskill.
Thanks for having me, Jason. It's great to be here.
So let's just get into it. We have the same set of questions for each of the candidates in this primary, and we'll start off with health care, which is a pressing issue for our area and a lot of rural areas. And do you have any policies or measures that you want to pursue to help residents remote parts of the county receive high-quality health care services without having to be shipped out of the county to get them?
So this is a huge issue. Health care, there are smaller mechanisms like the Medicare reimbursement rate. So the line for Medicare reimbursement rate actually runs between Orange and Sullivan County, where we have a lower Medicaid reimbursement rate than Orange County. So this happens with a lot of providers. I see this a lot on the Drug Task Force, that providers will come and look at Sullivan County and realize with the lower reimbursement rate, they can just hop the border back to Orange County. So that's something where it's a formula that needs to get reconsidered. And part of that formula is housing cost, which when they made that formula, you know, over 10, maybe 20 years ago, the housing cost was a little lower up here. Now, because of supply and demand and the low supply for housing, it's gone up, and that Medicaid reimbursement rate hasn't gone anywhere. And that also plays into, over the last couple of years, I've done a lot of tours of the hospital, had a lot of conversations with the leaders of the hospital. And a huge thing is staffing, workforce housing. Housing itself is a huge issue here, but particularly if we want to bring in professionals, we need to have somewhere for them to live. So that's nurses, doctors, you name it. If we want people to come in, they need somewhere to live.
So you're looking at a couple of those are at least two different ways that a completely different issue is impacting the issue of healthcare, that housing is impacting healthcare.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's hard to talk about one issue and not others. So many of them are so intertwined. And that's where, you know, these issues, you think it could be a simple yes or no, but there's so many other layers to it. And that's where having these years of experience in working in the Senate and Assembly, I've gotten to see where they intertwine. So like right now in the Assembly, there's over 10,000 bills. And over the years, a lot of them have, been reintroduced over and over. But yeah, very intertwined.
What can even be done at the state level to impact healthcare positively in our area?
So one would be reconsidering that formula. Another would be putting money towards more internship programs, making incentives for people to come here. And, you know, even when we come to our first responders, EMS, fire, something, and this is a bit more on the county level, but it comes back to Medicaid reimbursement rates that sometimes, fire or EMS will pick somebody up and bring them to the hospital. And, you know, if they need a specialist, a lot of times they'll go down to Orange County. One, that takes providers off of the map, that if more calls come in, it takes them a bit longer to get there. But two, a lot of times that Medicaid reimbursement will go to the person they picked up and doesn't actually always make it back to the provider. So again, these little mechanisms that sometimes go under the radar, but can make a huge difference.
And part of your response there, you're talking about, getting people to come to the area. Speaking of people coming to the area, tourism, and especially in Sullivan County, it's our major employer, major industry. How can you boost tourism while also addressing concerns that residents have who may be impacted by increased visitor traffic, increased tourism? Seems like there's two things. We need people to come here as tourists, but there's other folks that are worried about the negative impacts of a lot of people coming here. How do we balance that?
Absolutely. And that comes down to proper planning. If we just, again, a complicated answer. If we just go yes or no, we want people to come here or we don't want them to come here, there's really no solutions. So when we come down to actually making solutions and saying, you know what, if people are going to come here, we need to properly plan. And that goes to town planning boards and getting involved there. That comes down to, you know, transportation, DOT, talking to DOT. You know, over in Berryville, there was that horrible intersection that there was a lot of crashes. And that took multiple conversations with DOT to not only get the light there, but also proper signage. Because as you come over the hill on 55, there's been multiple layers of signage. So people do pause. And when people are coming from out of area, they don't know when they come over a hill that there's going to be a stoplight. So, you know, keeping the conversation, staying local. You know, I've attended a lot of community boards and staying in touch with people and listening. You know, a lot of this job isn't just getting out there and saying something big. It's listening. And that's something that I think is underrated in this position.
Along the lines of DOT involvement, things like that, and people coming to the area, how about the issue of Route 17 expansion? Do you have a stance on that one way or the other?
I mean, I sound like a broken record saying this, but again, a complicated issue. So when this passed originally 2 years ago, the plan to expand Route 17, there was also other conversation around it that had to do with warehouses. And again, that comes down to planning. If Sullivan County and the residents here want those warehouses or they don't, if nobody wants warehouses, there's no need to expand 17. And you know what? With the two lanes we have right now, they need a little more love and care. You know, I get worried about my tires sometimes when I hit a nice pothole. So to talk about three, maybe we need to talk about caring for the two. And then there's, you know, down in Mamikating, we talk about closing exits 114 and 115. So in closing those exits, again, sometimes in Albany, they'll just look at a list of exits and just look at things on paper and don't see the actual implications on the ground in the towns. Where when you close those exits, it's going to bring a lot of trucks through Wurtsboro and through the main villages that, you know, jumping back to tourism again, everything's so intertwined. You know, Wurtsboro is having a nice rise and a lot more shops and a lot of people walking around doing that shopping. So as you start bringing trucks in, you have an inherent danger there. So, you know, when we talk about 17, it's odd to make that jump, but not really. This is all intertwined. And it takes that advocacy and that local advocacy and getting those local voices in on the state issues.
Next question is about housing, which I know has already come up a couple times here, but just to like put a button on it. I mean, we know that there's a housing issue in our area, scarcity of new affordable housing or housing developments, especially in rural areas, which includes this assembly district. What can you do to ensure accessibility to housing for residents in Sullivan County?
Great issue. So we talked about that earlier with the workforce development and having workforce housing. So housing in general, it was something that recently passed in the state budget that I'm curious to see how it rolls out. A couple of years ago, there was a sunset on something called 421A, where any new development had to include affordable housing in it. And in that sunset, that happened to perfectly align when construction and expansion stopped in housing. So that did just pass, you know, a few weeks ago in the state budget. So I'm curious to see. They didn't call it 421A though. I believe it was called 845X. I could be wrong with the number, but it ended with X. And it's something similar that, as you build more luxury housing, there's tax breaks included for building portions that are affordable. And I'm hoping that makes an impact. You know, there's other conversations to be had. Again, a shortage of contractors. It's great what the county is doing to put some of our workforce that's looking for work into carpentry and teaching them the skills so we have more of those resources.
And now circling back to another issue that popped up and something you have some experience with is opioids and addiction. And it's a concern throughout the nation, of course. And then in our area, we have some of the highest rates of addiction and death due to addiction. Counties currently taking action to address the issue, but what additional measures do you think can be implemented? What would you like to do to continue to change this in the right way, make a positive change?
So, yes, Sullivan County has the highest or had the highest opioid overdose death rate in the state. And the past couple of years, there's been a lot of effort by a lot of people from providers, the hospital, community-based organizations. There's been some great ones getting out there, SALT, ATI. We need to bring in more providers. There's a backlog. People need help and there's not enough there. You know, shout out to Megan Galligan, who leads drug court. I actually also sit on drug court. And that's where we're trying different things to keep people in recovery. But, you know, so this past year, we've put out a lot of Naloxone boxes, getting Narcan out there. But it, again, it jumps back to the Medicaid reimbursement rate. If we want providers to come, we have to give them some incentive to come here. And, you know, more housing. When somebody goes into a rehab or recovery and they come back out and, you know, they go into the Nights Inn motel or back into a home where everybody else around them is using, it's hard for them to stay clean. And, you know, I myself, you know, I'm almost 3 years out with no alcohol. And so I've had the experience myself of getting sober, and it's giving me an insight in a lot of this planning and working with the drugs task force the last couple of years. And yeah, we just need more resources. Let people know that there is help there. You know, I've been in those motels, and, you know, I've been tabling outside of the Monticello Library where they had some issues with overdoses and a lot of use over there. So, you know, I've been getting my hands dirty and getting in there. And I do have a lot of ideas. And having that insight to bring that to the state where sometimes people are a bit removed and don't necessarily have the knowledge and experience of what can actually help people.
And, you know, just take a minute to ask you this quick, because you said it's really important to get out there and talk to people. Like, as you've been working on this campaign, getting close to the primary election, you've been talking to people. What have you been hearing? What are you hearing from folks?
Well, it depends who you talk to. Actually, I was outside the library yesterday, and man and woman came outside. They were sitting on the benches, and they were telling me about overdoses happening, and they were saying it would be great if there was a center where, you know, you could take somebody right in town here. And actually, on the drug task force, one of the major things we're working on is a stabilization center. And in the next couple of weeks, we're going to be rolling out some community surveys on what that looks like, what services will be provided. But that, and, you know, then you talk to the first responders, law enforcement, first responders, fire, EMS are getting called all the time for overdoses. And a lot of times those people go right back out there. You know, we talk to police, they're not able to hold people. And, you know, it comes back to bail reform. And when we talk about bail reform, it also stops us from getting people help. Because sometimes people are released the same day, and now they're in danger of going and possibly fatally overdosing because they just had an overdose and were saved. And, you know, a few hours later, they're walking away. And so Liberty has been great. We've been working with Liberty Police on a quick response team, which that kicked off last year. It's been doing great. That 24 to 72 hours after a non-fatal overdose, a peer recovery specialist and a police officer will go and talk to that person and encourage them to get into recovery. And the numbers have been pretty good. They're now expanding into Fallsburg Police Department and hopefully soon to Monticello as well as the Sheriff's Department. So, you know, we're having hopeful numbers. The overdose deaths this year over last year have gone down. And while a lot of Narcan has been getting out there, so it's hard to read the non-fatal overdoses, I'm hopeful. And, you know, we can't take the foot off the gas. I think a lot of people, a lot of organizations have really been involved in this. And thank you to them. And thank you to everybody getting involved on this.
All right. And the last question is befitting of the campaign time. And this is the question we ask everybody on our way out, which is, Why would you say folks should vote for you over your opponent?
Well, I could say that it's a lot of experience. So just this past week, Proposition 2 was thrown off the ballot, and it's going to get appealed, but it was thrown off the ballot because of procedural errors. And that's where, you know, I have been working in the background on a lot of this for a long time, and knowing what I'm doing with this is a real tool. A lot of times people come into these offices and they think it's just ceremonial, but it's a lot of work. And I know how to do it, and I've been doing it for a long time. But, you know, also on the back end, I really look at this as public service, and I always have. I actually didn't go to school for politics at all. I went for accounting and business. But every school I went to, every organization I went to, every community I've been in, I've always been involved because I think it's the right thing to do. And, you know, just yesterday I was working with a school board member. A couple months ago at Sullivan West, there was a threat of violence. And that person was arrested and released the same day. So I was helping a school board member write a resolution that would give judges the discretion to hold somebody. Because you know what? When somebody's threatening violence on a school and they're let out before school is even over that day, I mean, that's scary. And, you know, when it comes down to it, we all want a safe place for us and our families to live and thrive. And that's part of that.
Well, Camille O'Brien, I want to thank you again for coming out to talk to us and let our listeners know where you stand. And I wish you the best of luck on primary day.
Thank you so much, Jason. Thank you for having me.
Great.
That's Jason Dole speaking to Camille O'Brien, who is one of the two GOP candidates for the Republican nomination for the 100th Assembly District. The GOP Republicans will be choosing those candidates to run in the general on June 25th in the primary election. The other candidate is Lou Ingracia. Tonight, Patricio Rubio will speak to him. On the Democratic side, that seat has already been chosen. That candidate's already been chosen. Excuse me. That's Paula Kaye, who will run against whoever wins in the primary between Lou Ingracia and Camille O'Brien in the general. And again, that 100th district is the seat being vacated by Aileen Gunther. Reminder, early voting for the June 25th primary begins on Saturday and runs through June 23rd. Applications to register to vote must be received by the Board of Elections no later than June 15th to be eligible to vote in the primary election. If you're already registered, the deadline to change your party affiliation has already passed. We'll take a break, and when we come back, how to be a better beekeeper. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hi, this is Jeff, your host on Radio Catskill's show, Electric Mountain. I'll be playing a choice selection of house, techno, electro, and a whole lot more. And every week, I'll feature a guest DJ spinning a continuous set, bringing their unique style. Come dance with us on Electric Mountain, each and every Saturday night, 12 to 2, exclusively done on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
This is Radio Chatskill. Early summer is a busy time for honeybee colonies. They forage for nectar and pollen, nurture their larvae, and produce and store honey. But beekeepers are busy too. Radio Catskill reporter Chia Tien Nicole Chen spoke with a beekeeping expert to find out about beekeeping management, a key aspect of honeybee health.
The first known records of the human practice of keeping honeybees dates back 4,400 years to ancient Egypt. But with a shifting climate and evolving agricultural practices, there's still a lot to learn about keeping honeybees.
This morning, I was home alone and I saw a new paper come out, and I, like, out loud, I was like, oh my God. I'm at almost 30 years studying these creatures, and I learned something new every single day. It's crazy. You know, it's like the more you know, the less you know.
Robin Underwood is the Extension Educator of Apiculture at Penn State, where she also conducts research on honeybee health and beekeeping practices.
My job is to teach beekeepers how to be better beekeepers. It's super fun.
Beekeepers manage honeybees not just for their delicious honey, but also because they pollinate agricultural crops, over $300 million worth of them in New York State alone, according to the Department of Agriculture. So when entire bee colonies started dying out for no clear cause in 2006, their keepers panicked. Their livelihoods were on the line. As a honeybee researcher, Underwood watched this unfold.
So this colony collapse disorder is called a disorder because we don't really know the cause. The key to the colony's survival is the workers and the queen. During colony collapse disorder, the adult population just drastically diminishes very quickly to the point of just a few hundred bees in the queen or no bees at all. But they left behind food, babies. It's just very strange.
Beekeepers were losing up to 90% of their colonies over the winter. In the first reported case of the disorder, a Pennsylvania beekeeper who had brought his hives down to Florida for overwintering lost nearly three quarters of his 3,000 colonies. Just 800 of them survived till spring.
That's a big deal for pollination. It's a really big deal for that business to lose all of that.
Reports of colony collapse disorder, or CCD, have dropped in recent years.
I don't really hear about it anymore. I don't see it in my own colonies. I really never have.
In 2022, the USDA's agricultural census recorded that there were 3.8 million bee colonies nationwide, a record high since 2007. This increase is caused, in part, by the way beekeeping practices have changed since CCD entered the picture.
That problem that we've had, you know, with CCD, et cetera, has really taught beekeepers to change their ways. Partly, they keep more colonies than they really need to hedge against those losses that may occur over the winter, because by next spring, we want to make sure there's the right number.
Though they now have more colonies, beekeepers continue to face challenges. The Bee Informed Partnership, a nonprofit that works with beekeepers and researchers to improve honeybee health, conducts an annual survey on colony loss. In 2023, beekeepers reported that they lost an average of over 1 in 3 of their colonies over the winter. They mentioned poor nutrition, bad weather, and queen-related issues as contributing factors. But the number one cause of winter colony loss is a type of parasitic mite called the varroa mite.
We say they're like having a tick the size of a dinner plate biting you, the size comparison. And they not only are feeding on the bees as adults and as immatures, but they spread and activate viruses. So the viruses are really the killer.
Good beekeeping management practices. That's the key to maintaining healthy colonies.
It's hard to fix something when you don't know what the disease agent is, and all you can do is try to manage your colonies the best you can for their health.
Underwood has been sharing resources on organic beekeeping management.
We did a research project where side by side, we followed colonies that were managed with a conventional system, an organic system, and then an entirely chemical-free system. It was clear that chemical-free management led to high mortality of the bees. And so, you know, either conventional or organic are great. But if you don't need to use synthetic chemicals, why would you? I felt very confident that if other beekeepers tried the management that I did, they would have equal success. And I felt that it was something positive to share.
She's developed an online self-paced course called Beekeeping 102 Organic Honeybee Colony Management, which you can take on the Penn State Extension website.
It goes through a series of things to read and short videos. It describes the research that I had mentioned. Then we go on to say, where should you put your bees and how do you choose where that location is? What are the non-chemical ways of controlling mites? What are the chemical ways that are allowed in organic? And then, by the way, there's a whole series of other pests that you also need to manage organically. So we go through each of those and what's allowed and what's not allowed. And then finally, it's sort of like a year in the life of a beekeeper. So I just told you all the things that you can do, but when should you do them? So it goes through spring, summer, fall, and winter using what you learned.
Underwood notes that using organic beekeeping treatments does not mean that you are USDA organic certified.
The thing about bees is they fly really far and you cannot fence them in and keep them on your farm. So they can get themselves into things in the environment that could be a problem for organic certification. So there are recommendations for certification, but they require pretty much, you know, 3 miles in every direction to be clean. And if you look at a map, that is an enormous area. The only certified organic honeybee products from the United States are from Hawaii. There are not any from the continental U.S., and it's because of that land use. So I just wanted to make that distinction.
Throughout our conversation, I was intrigued by Underwood's dedication to learning about honeybees. I mean, she has a PhD in entomology, and she's been researching them for nearly 3 decades. Did you grow up around beekeepers?
No. In fact, my mother is deathly afraid of all those yellow and black striped stingy guys. So maybe it's a bit of rebellion. I'm not sure. It's just, you know, it's a great passion for people that are lifelong learners. You know, when I go out to see my bees and they're healthy and making lots of honey, you know, I feel it in my soul. It's just kind of a part of me.
Liberty, I'm Jatia Nicole Chen for Radio Catskill.
Robin Underwood's course, Beekeeping 102, Organic Honeybee Colony Management, is available at Penn State Extension's website, extension.psu.edu. We'll take a break, and when we come back, a preview of Honesdale's Roots and Rhythm Music and Arts Festival. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Legendary oceanographer Sylvia Earle has spent 8 decades exploring underwater, and she has some good news.
We have the evidence. Areas that are protected, safeguarded in the ocean, you can see recovery.
How We Save the Ocean, part 2 of our series. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Friday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Honesdale's Roots and Rhythm Music and Arts Festival returns to Central Park in Honesdale this coming weekend, Father's Day weekend. The festival committee brings blues, rock, Americana, roots, and jazz touring bands to the area. And here to tell us more about this year's event is Roots and Rhythm Chairman Jamie Sunkard. Jamie, good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, thanks for being here.
Looking forward to getting everyone to inspired to come for Roots and Rhythm.
Yeah, so I mentioned that you're returning to Central Park after a break, so tell us about the music. Who's playing this year?
Oh, yeah, we got a good lineup here. Now, usually we have 4 bands going throughout the day, but this year we added an extra band, so we have 5, and we're starting at 12:30, going till probably close to dark. So it's just going to be going on all day, and don't forget this is a free concert. One of the people that's coming is going to be Dickerson and the Whippersnappers. That's kind of a mouthful just to say, but he's kind of known for his Americana roots music with a little new creativity going into it. Steve Geiger is going to be with us. Steve Geiger is one of the first people in one of our first festivals to play, and so we're bringing him back again. He's known as a legendary blues harmonica player. Roberta Faceplant is going to be a fun one too.
I love that name.
Honky Tonk Hurricane with a voice that blends the raw rock and roll grit of Janis Joplin with a little bit of Patsy Cline thrown in. Then we see now we have Pat Rochelle, Annie Raines, and a guitar, harmonica, vocals combination. Slam Allen, who's also going to be great, he's calls himself the Messenger of Love, who's got a genre of blues, soul, rock and roll, touch of R&B, little B.B. King kind of stuff going on. So that's the lineup we got going.
That's great. It's all day Saturday, a great lineup all day long. Now, what, you know, we mentioned that it's the Music and Arts Festival. So what role do the arts play in this year's festival?
Well, we always like to have on the side street, we have one side is the food vendors and the other side is the marketplace. And these are artisans and craftspeople, and it's everything from jewelry to leather work to photography. This year, our guest artist is Connor, who's a local artist, and he's going to be doing a photograph gallery where people can come in and have photographs taken. So it'll be a lot of kind of interactive stuff going on as well.
Okay, cool. And then what about the Tunes and Tales event for the youngsters? What's that all about?
Yeah, Tunes and Tales. We always have right in the park, we have a tent. And this year is going to be someone's going to be doing some homemade harmonicas, some bubble wands. There's going to be like a giant Jenga there and a giant Lego for people to play with. So it's something to kind of keep the kids occupied when the grown-ups are doing their thing, listening to the music.
The festival, of course, is celebrating music and art, but also you guys have a unique thing with this festival to promote sustainability. And I want to talk a little bit about sustainability at the festival. The Roots actually won a national award from the EPA in the award category of innovation as part of the Food Recovery Challenge in 2017. And you've won other awards over the course of the Roots and Rhythm Festival. Talk to us about sustainability and why it's so important to feature that at the Roots and Rhythm Music and Arts Festival.
No, yeah, thanks for letting people know about that. Well, as we move into the future, I think everyone's realizing we need to figure out ways to get plastic off the planet and ways to get everything recycled so it doesn't end up in the landfill. And so we're making that part of our commitment with Roots and Rhythms, where we're recycling the paper and the plastics and the glass and all of that stuff as well. So we'll be having, you know, one thing for trash, because there's always some stuff, you know, that you just can't recycle. But a good portion of what we have for waste material will be recycled.
Yeah, and it's not just putting out the recycling containers. There's actually a recycling committee, a group of volunteers from various community organizations that are helping with this. Talk to us a little bit about the recycling committee and how the volunteers are passionate about this aspect of the festival as well.
Well, this year we have some of the volunteers we have are some of the high school students, so it's nice to know that high school is the kids are being involved with stuff like this. Brian Fulp from the Himalayan Institute is kind of overseeing things, and of course the Himalayan Institute has a very extensive sustainability program that they've instituted out there. So, yeah, so get people aware of trying to get stuff put in the right place instead of the landfill.
Yeah, I want to stay on this for just a little bit, because in your website you have a whole section about sustainability, and to show the work that you guys have been doing and how impactful it is, I just want to mention some of the statistics here. In 2010, the Roots and Rhythm Festival collected more than 4,200 pounds of quote garbage, but after years of working on getting to zero waste, at the end of the 2016 event, you only collected 360 pounds of trash. Now, that's amazing to get toward that zero waste goal, and having the whole community, united in the effort.
Yeah. that's thanks for bringing those things up. It's a big effort to try to get all that to happen.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on that effort, and also, you know, being acknowledged for it, a 3-time Waste Watcher Award recipient as a result of waste being diverted. So good to know. It's a day of music and fun, but also, so, you know, concern about the environment. Want to also just ask you a couple, other, FAQs, I guess. There are places to sit in the park, and can people bring their own food into the park?
Well, sure. People, of course, there's no alcohol allowed, but we will be having a what we're calling it a sipping lounge adjacent to the park, where people, where local breweries Here and Now and Runaway Train are going to be highlighting some of their local brews. But yes, people can bring in their own food. But there's we have food vendors, and there's going to be some amazing food there. I always say great music deserves great food. And so there'll be everything from your classic sausage and peppers, hot dogs and hamburgers, to local ice cream from Creamworks and Italian ice, crepes, Mexican food. There's going to be a wide range, so you don't need to bring your own food. There'll be plenty of fun food to eat there.
Yeah, and people can bring lawn chairs or blankets to sit on. Public seating is there, but it's limited. It's mainly grass there at the park.
That's a good point. I mean, it's not like we don't have chairs set up or anything like that. Yeah. I mean, we expect 5,000 people to be coming to this event. So
yeah, it's a big event.
And Mother Nature has shined on us. Looks like we're going to have a beautiful day tomorrow. So we've been really real fortunate in that. I should also add, if you want to check out more information about this, you should go to our website, HonesdaleRootsAndRhythm.com, and that's got more information about all the musicians, and it has an extensive archive of the events that we've had through the years. This will be our 17th festival. So
yeah, it's a great,
keep it going.
Great website, and there's also under the info tab all those FAQs about directions, parking, pets, so whether you can bring them, you can, but they have to be leashed, and please bring your own disposal bags. But yeah, it's going to be a great day. It's kicking off at what, 12:30? Is that right with the music?
12:30, yeah. There's now downtown, there's going to be Main Street bands happening starting at 10. So you can wander around down Main Street, check out the stores down on Main Street, listen to some good music before the main event starting in Central Park.
All right, great. Jamie Stuckert is the chairman of Roots and Rhythm Music and Arts Festival, also proprietor of Nature's Grace Health Foods there on Main Street. I think I caught you at a busy time, so I'll let you get back to work. Thanks for telling us about the festival, and have a great...
Thank you so much, Jim.
Have a great event.
Looking forward to seeing everyone out there.
All right. And before we go, we've been telling you about our partnership with StoryCorps called One Small Step here at Radio Catskill, where we're pairing strangers to talk to each other and record their conversations about their lives, and not about politics, but about their lives, a conversation. This morning, we want to give you an opportunity to hear one of those conversations to see how it all works. This was previously recorded as part of the One Small Step program from StoryCorps. This is Alton Russell. He's the former chair of the Republican Party in Columbus, Georgia, and Wayne Hales. He's the president of the local chapter of the NAACP there. They never had a conversation until the One Small Step program from StoryCorps. Take a listen.
I went to Houston looking for a job, and went in this little old bitty office. There was a guy sitting at the desk. He said, what will you do? And I said, anything as long as it's legal. He says, good answer. How about $40 a week? And I said, yes, sir. This was 1961. He said, by the way, my name is George Bush. It was George H.W.
Really?
Bush. Yes, sir. And he was running for Congress. What my job was is I made yard signs with a wooden stake and a piece of poster board and a stencil.
But you've never run for office?
No,
you've
never.
You've just been the kingmaker.
Well, I don't know about that, but I never have run.
What do you do for a living?
Believe it or not, I'm a toilet paper salesman.
Really?
Yes, sir.
Two-ply?
Two-ply, wiping up, yeah. I've been there 40 years.
Is that right?
Yeah. But you've done a lot of different things, too. And I just wondered, how in the world did you wind up in Columbus, Georgia? Did you take a wrong turn?
I was working for the YMCA, and the YMCA here called and said, would I be interested? But as the president of the NAACP, I can tell you how I got into that. When we were growing up, about 8 or 9 years old, we were traveling to my grandfather's house, and we stopped at a laundromat. And when we went in, they said, we don't wash black folks' clothes here. Of course, they didn't use black folks' word. My father being a preacher, you know, he was cool, but my mother was ready to go off, you know. And we went on to my grandfather's house, and he got on the phone. He called the NAACP. And about 30 minutes later, they said, going back up to the laundromat. And the white owner stood in the corner while we washed our clothes, red as a beet. So I'm like, oh, man. And that was a memory that's always been in my mind and how it worked.
But you know what? I have a good friend of mine. We went to breakfast one morning, and when we left, this guy that was in the restaurant came out and followed me to my truck. And he said, are you Alton Russell? And I said, yes, I am. He says, well, I saw you on TV the other day. He said, but I got a question. How can you be a Republican and eat breakfast with that black guy? I said, what did you say? That guy's a friend of mine. You're way off base. We got things to do, and worrying about whether you're man or woman, black or white, is not what you need to be focusing on.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, I've got a whole different view of you. My perception was, okay, he's always going to be over here. I'm not going to even talk with him. But this has been eye-opening for me.
Well, it has to me, too.
And I can go tell some people, Alton's not that bad. He's all right.
It's been fun. Yeah. And I'm really glad to have met you. I sure am.
That is an excerpt from One Small Step, presented by StoryCorps. We believe it's our patriotic duty to have those conversations to change perceptions, bridge the divide. You can be a part of that. You can join us as we record conversations in the Catskills and upstate New York and northeast Pennsylvania for One Small Step. We've partnered with StoryCorps. Go to our website, wjffradio.org. We'll be matching participants and hosting recorded conversations throughout the whole year. You can apply to be matched for the One Small Step program. Just click on the red square icon on the right. It says One Small Step, and you'll go to the website. Learn more information. There's some answers to some of the questions you might have, but we wanted to have you get a taste of what it's like. It's really just a conversation between two folks who don't really know each other and who might come from different political viewpoints or different viewpoints, two strangers coming together to have a conversation and an effort to bring our communities together one conversation at a time. Check it out, wjffradio.org. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening, and we'll leave you with one of the bands that's playing at the Honesdale Roots and Rhythm Music and Arts Festival. It's Deke Dickerson and an appropriate song. Have a great day.
Searching for light in the darkness of insanity, I ask myself, is all hope lost? Is there only pain and hatred and misery? And each time I feel like this inside, there's one thing I wanna know. So funny about peace, love, and understanding.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeff Works Office Solutions, located right on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York. A newly renovated pet-friendly office space that rents by the day, week, or month, with hot desks, sound-insulated rooms, Wi-Fi, modern amenities, and 24-hour secure access. Online at jeffworksjville.com. And from The Cooperage Project, thecooperageproject.org. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Celebrate Pride Weekend in the Sullivan Catskills, June 14th to 16th. Drag Me to the Catskills, a drag show event and celebration of LGBTQ+ pride and self-expression, with drag queen performances, dance parties, brunch, and more. Drag Me to the Catskills, June 14th to 16th.
More information at dragmetothecatskills.com. It's going to be a fabulous weekend in the Catskills. Paid for by Sullivan Catskills Visitors Association.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at wjffradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill. Local news, conversation, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, partly sunny, warmer, high 83. Partly cloudy tonight, mild but more humid, a low 61. And looking ahead, thunderstorms, some heavy, late tomorrow morning through tomorrow afternoon. On Point is coming up next. It's 11 o'clock.